Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Pam Houston is the director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of California at Davis. She's the best-selling author of Cowboys Are My Weakness, and most recently, the number one best-selling Denver Post author of Contents May Have Shifted. She's also an old friend of the Tattered Cover, and when Pam draws your attention to an emerging writer, you should take heed. Of Christian Kiefer's novel, Pam writes, "The Infinite Tides is the most emotionally and syntactically sophisticated debut I have seen, possibly ever." Christian holds a doctorate in American literature from UC Davis and is on the English faculty of American River College in Sacramento. He's an accomplished poet, songwriter, and musician. We're delighted that Pam Houston is here tonight to engage Christian Kiefer in conversation in honor of the publication of The Infinite Tides. Would you please join me in making Pam and Christian feel welcome?
Well, hi. Thanks for coming. I thought that I would just say a few words about why I'm here, and then we'll turn things over to Christian. But I've taught at Davis for quite a while now, and I was teaching there when Christian was a PhD student. He didn't take a creative writing class while he was there, or at least not from me. But we got to be friends just a little bit, and he asked me to read a book he was working on and give him some feedback, which I did. And then 10 years went by, and I knew about Christian's music, and I had seen him perform once, I think, and listened to his CDs. And then I heard that he sold this book and that it was coming out, and it was a novel, and he had asked me to read it and offer a quote for the cover. And, you know, and I was very happy to do that, not really thinking, you know, thinking it would probably be pretty good, you know, like a lot of the books that come across my desk. And then I found myself reading this book that just completely captivated my imagination. It completely... it was really, for me, an entrancing book. It tried to do so many difficult things, and it pulled them off. You're going to hear a little bit from it, and I don't want to steal any of the thunder, but at the center of the book, as you already know, because you've probably read the jacket cover, is an astronaut, and a math genius, and he has spent his whole life trying to get into space, and at this moment of culmination of everything he's worked for in his life, a tragedy, the worst type of tragedy, befalls him back home. And these two things happen literally simultaneously, and that becomes this math problem that he can't solve, that all his math theory won't work out for him. And the rest of the book, after this glorious moment in space when he's ignorant of the tragedy, takes place either in a cul-de-sac or a Starbucks. And you would think that would be boring, and it is so not boring. And living inside Keith Corcoran's head is you know, I read so many books, and especially right at the moment, I'm reading so many books because I'm back in the public eye because of my book, and so I'm getting lots and lots of books in the mail, and I've read so many books this spring. And you know, this is not a short book, but I wanted it to go on. I could have gone on for 300 more pages. I was that happy reading it, and that was because of the quality of the writing, the quality of the story, how interesting Christian made Keith Corcoran in his stasis. You know, he's really stuck, but he's so interesting in that stuck place. And I just think that in and of itself is an amazing accomplishment. So I said to Christian, why don't we go on a little mini tour at my favorite bookstores in the West? And so that's why we're here. Christian Kiefer.
That sounds really interesting. Yeah, so I thought I would just read the very, very beginning, which is just a short sort of 5-page chunk, and it sort of sets up the language. And a lot of my concerns with it were linguistic, like I was just talking to my friends about picking the right vocabulary, you know, and every book sort of, every book, like every poem, has its own sort of vocabulary. And this book, the vocabulary became very much sort of about math and science and engineering. So there was a lot of time spent kind of figuring out how to incorporate that language into the book. And this opening bit will give you a little sense of the writing when it's sort of at its most florid.
No.
Mathematical.
Lyric.
Lyric.
About lyric.
It's a much better word.
Much better than florid.
Much better vocabulary than florid.
Let me just say before he starts that I said, what's it about? And he said, it's about a depressed astronaut. And I said, you're going to have to do better than that when you go out on tour.
Well, now this will be podcast, so I'll put it on my phone and I'll just play the thing that you said before to anyone who asks. So this is the beginning of The Infinite Tides. I had to check to make sure that's what it's called. The airlock opened. He knew there would be no perceptible change in pressure, but now that the moment had arrived, he somehow expected the transition of atmosphere to be audible. For the brief symphony of thumps and clicks between the shuttle and the docking node to include the hiss or shush or sigh of oxygen exchange. And yet, despite the absence of such a marker, the swing of the hatch felt to Keith like a sudden outrushing of the tide. A sensation that remained with him as he floated through the opening and entered the harmony module where the crew they had come to relieve all smiled expectantly back at him. It was a moment as glorious and transcendent as any he could have imagined, and he would realize only later that it represented the single coordinate point in which he understood that he had done it, that at last he had entered the long, incredible upward-turning arc that had been the trajectory of his life, and that he was, finally and undeniably, an astronaut. In the days to follow, he would try to describe the experience. But what words were there for such a moment? He thought first of numbers, not of words, but then he always had. The seemingly infinite parallels that extended off the edges of the grid forever in their ongoing X and Y coordinates had finally intersected on some Z plane that he had thought about since his earliest days and yet had never been able to truly understand or plot or calculate. He had stared at it through the window of the shuttle on their approach, the interconnected tubes, and the fanning wings of the solar arrays stretching out like some magnificent metal flower above the blue swirl of Earth. And even then he was thinking of the numbers, the average speed of 17,239 miles per hour in an orbit very nearly that of a perfect circle, the apogee and perigee perhaps 10 kilometers in difference and inclining to 51.6459 degrees, the angle of its motion, the angle of its helixed continuance, the feeling of weightlessness itself so familiar and comfortable it was as if he had lived within that condition for the entirety of his life. And in many ways he had. He would ask himself if this had been his destiny, and each time he would answer yes. He would answer yes, 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 as if the weightlessness of his body was itself the vindication and proof that a life spent huddled over paper scratched through with the symbology of mathematics had indeed been the true vector, the numbers themselves extant in a universe that was this universe and no other. Days and nights spinning past in 45-minute increments, continents and oceans and weather patterns unscrolling under the round porthole windows, the lit webwork of cities and roads on the black sphere of the planet below, and the flow of the numbers, his numbers, in everything, always. In his memory, that moment of passing through the hatch would resolve itself into an unambiguous image of triumph. But there had been something else as well, a sensation so fast and intense and so quickly gone again that it had been easy to forget. There had been that feeling of pride, the rush of his success, of all the years of his labor coalescing into this finally solved equation. But for one instant, there had also been the clutch of an impossible helplessness so complete and staggering that it seemed to seize at his heart. A flicker, and then gone. In its wake, only the after echo of a distant high-pitched ringing that vibrated through him even as it returned to silence once again. As he stared into the smiling faces of the crew and told himself that yes, he was meant to be here, that it had been his destiny to succeed, and so he had succeeded. The sense of panic already replaced by the pride of his accomplishment, replaced so completely that he would not remember that flicker, would not allow himself to remember, even after everything else had happened. In his memory of that moment, he was an astronaut, and they were welcoming him aboard the space station. And in his memory, he was smiling. Is this not what he was meant to do? Is the answer not as fixed and indisputable as any question he might have been tasked to solve? Watch them now. The numbers as if stretched upon a wire. The sixes stacked astride the decimal. The 7 and 3 and 0s behind them. Study them all your days, and then ask yourself how any such equation could describe anything at all. The water rushing across the sand, the tiny stars, the way her hand curled into his. They could not even describe the way he felt about the numbers themselves, what they had meant to him, what they would continue to mean. Such equations to imagine. Now watch them vanish into the spiraled lemniscate of what is to come. This, the black firmament, this, the dark matter flowing into and out of your heart. So that's how it starts, and then it's a comedy. Just a laugh a minute, as you can tell from the light opening.
So I have a question for you. I'll ask a few questions, and then you guys can ask a few questions, and then maybe Christian will read another section.
Maybe you will read too.
Maybe I'll read a little section. My question when I read the book, the astronaut, once he comes back from space, is quite alone, and he spends a lot of his time alone in his house in the cul-de-sac, and eventually he meets some other people, but there was so much aloneness. And one of the things that I find staggering about Christian's own life is that he has 5, very soon to be 6 children, which makes me believe he's never alone. And so I really, as I was turning pages of this book in a way that, you know, you only have a chance to do if you know the author, I was thinking, how does he even know what it's like to be alone? Let alone, why would he write a whole novel about a man alone, considering that's about the hardest thing there is to do, is to write a novel about a man alone and make it move. So I wondered where that came from.
Yeah. Well, it's probably wishful thinking. You know, part of it is the act of writing is so alone. I read that James Joyce did a lot of writing at his kitchen table with his brats screaming and running about him in a big circle all the time. And, even if I am at the kitchen table and all my kids are there, you know, when you're writing and you break through into that inner place where the writing comes from, I mean, the house could be on fire and you wouldn't notice until somebody came up and went, hey, you know, what? Leave me alone. So part of it is that, I mean, the aloneness is in the internal state that you sort of get to when you're working. Part of it also is, I didn't always have the children, and I was divorced in my 30s and, you know, moved in with my mom and had my car repossessed and, you know, and all that stuff happened. And, you know, you spend a lot of time alone, or you used to have a partner all the time, feeling like the rug got pulled out from under you and wondering what to do next, because the thing you thought you were building turns out to have a faulty foundation or whatever. So part of it is that, part of it is artistic, and part of it is comes from the past. I mean, we all know, I think intuitively, I mean, we all have that alone thing inside. I do. I think we all do, probably.
Another question that I've been thinking about, and I think probably people who aren't affiliated with the university might think, oh, he has a PhD in American literature. Well, that makes sense that he would write a book. But in fact, that's just not true. I just had a panel at Davis that I put together for the graduating master's students and brought some master's students who had gone on to write and gone into work in publishing and gone on to get their PhDs. And without exception, the PhDs who I had invited back, and this was not planned, said, oh no, I don't write. I don't write anymore. Like, as if that was such a childish thing they did once upon a time before they really got straight and started to think about theory all day. And so I wonder about you and your process with the PhD and how that informed this book. The book has a lot of math in it and some math theory in it, but it's not, I would say, overburdened by theory. And so I just wonder how that worked out for you, like getting the PhD, if you never felt you were committing one way or the other. Obviously you didn't, because here you are, but I'm interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I really care about, beyond the obvious, my children and my wife, is making art, you know. And the PhD was an excuse to teach myself how to read better. And, you know, my students now ask me, like, well, you know, should I go get a PhD? And I said, I don't know, are you afraid of reading? Because I think a lot of people are. I mean, you're not afraid of reading some books, but then, you know, you've never read Ulysses, mm-hmm. because it scares the crap out of you, right? I mean, the one thing about getting a PhD is all that fear goes away. Like, you're not afraid of reading anything, mm-hmm. ever, at all. And that's, you know, as a writer, that's pretty damn valuable, actually. But then there's plenty of other people who aren't afraid of reading anything anyway, mm-hmm. right? So for me, that's what that was about. And you know, I got the PhD because I wanted to be an artist. You know, I wanted to do this. I wanted to paint and make prints and make records and write poetry. And I learned pretty early that it's pretty rare to make a living doing that stuff. In fact, when I was 18, I got a backstage pass to see a musician named Chris Whitley, a musician who I really loved, a guitar player, singer-songwriter. And I went backstage, and I was sort of nervous, and he was on Sony and had a big producer, and I thought, like, wow, you know, he's like, this is like big time. Was at the Strand, I think, in LA or somewhere like that. And I went backstage, and it was, can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
It was a shitty, dingy, smoky, disgusting room. And he was on this broken sofa with a tequila shot in one hand and chain smoking in the other. And he looked, you know, on the stage he looked godlike, but backstage he, you know, he was just wrecked. And I looked around, and I just thought, I got to get a job. and it has to be good. It has to be a good job. Because if this is what it's like to make it, like, I am fucked. And, You know, and since then, I put out a bunch of records and did a bunch of touring, and I recognize that as a totally typical backstage at a rock club. But and I will also say Chris Whitley smoked himself to lung cancer at age 45 or something like that. And part of that is just, you know, having to make a living. You know, friends of mine who are essentially professional musicians, you know, they make their money on the road. They don't make their money selling CDs, you know, so they have to be out. You know, making a CD is just a reason to get the record company to help you get out on the road again. So, and that, you know, being on the road is a lot of too much downtime is what it is, right? So, you know, the PhD was essentially a way to survive, you know, not just financially survive, but to have something solid so that I didn't have to think about ever, will this book sell? Will this record sell? You know, how am I going to pay the mortgage based on the next thing that I do? I could just do stuff. Mm-hmm. So I put out a record, and one is, you know, one will be songs and the next one will be experimental, impossible to listen to, you know, art. Because I don't, if it sells, if it doesn't sell, that's okay. So it was also sort of insulating me from my perception of, mm-hmm. of, compromise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's why I have a job.
Plus, there's the health insurance.
The health insurance is the main reason I have a job.
Yeah.
But it's also with the idea that I, at least with the fiction, I can protect it. You know, that's also why I write magazine articles. When I started this book, and I knew it was going to be made up of 144 tiny chapters, I did not necessarily think that my New York publisher was going to be the one who wanted it, and
yeah.
I didn't necessarily think anyone would read it, but I had my job to...
Well, I think your books have been riskier...
Since I got the job.
Yeah, well, Sighthound was after the job, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, your first books are brilliant and easily comprehensible. Short pieces
mm-hmm.
of a length that we're accustomed to seeing for short pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And then abruptly, sort of abruptly for us, comes Sighthound, a novel from essentially from the point of view of a dog. Or with...
12 first-person narratives.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of Faulkner.
From Yeah, right? And then this book, which if you've not read it, is 144 essentially fragments of... what I would call travel writing, but like you took a ton of different travel narratives about travel all over the world and ripped a couple of pages out of each one and put a book together from them. Now, I will say, as you get to sort of the midpoint, you start to go, oh, that person was this person, and then it starts to come together and you realize this is a novel. But, you know, it's a very structurally difficult book. Not to read it, but, I mean, as a writer reading that, I was like, man, how did she do it? How did you do it?
I moved everything for 3 years. I moved all those 144 pieces around for 3 years until they found their right position. But that leads me back to ask you about this book. I'm trying to get you to talk. I know. But for me, I will for a second here. For me, I need to have a form. Like, even if I violate the form, the thing I need to feel safe enough to move forward in a novel is a form. And for Sighthound, that was these 12 alternating speakers that would take turns telling this ongoing story. And for this book, I'm stuck on the number 12. It was 12 sets of 12 travel narratives with punctuated by stories that take place on airplanes. And once I knew I had 144 boxes to fill, I felt safe enough to go forward. So for me, it's always form. It's like finding the form allows the book to be written, even if I suspect I will violate that form later. And so, I mean, a novel is such a daunting proposition. I love all those things in the Margaret Atwood book about going into a room where all the lights are turned off and the furniture's been rearranged. You know, every single metaphor, she interviewed about 100 novelists, and every single metaphor is about going into a dark place and not being able to see and having to accomplish something before the lights come on or before the door opens or before the tunnel, you know. What was your process in terms of, you know, did it start with Keith or did it start with math or did it start with grief or what Sorry. how did it begin? And
it started with NPR.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, NPR. So NPR, you know, 2007, I guess, the lead news story on NPR every day was unemployment. I mean, every day it was like men who were brain surgeons and the hospital shut down, and men who were steel workers and the steel mill shut down, you know, just all kinds of men, sometimes women, but really it was a story about men being out of work. And I at the same time I was at spending a lot of time at Starbucks grading papers, being the last man in America who had a job, and watching men come in with their newspapers and sit down and circle the want ads in the morning. And then an hour later, they'd be reading the sports page. And then an hour later, they'd be reading some other section. And then lunchtime would come and they would disappear. And then they would come back with a paper, maybe a different paper. And they'd sort of start all over. And you know, I was sitting there and I just started to kind of take notes about it. You know, and really, there was a moment at which I thought, oh, these are the men that are on NPR all the time. Here they all are at my Starbucks, you know. But you know, part of it was realizing that they're looking for jobs, sort of, but really they're trying to fill 8 hours by doing something that they don't feel guilty about, right? Because they at the end of the 8 hours, they have to go home and say, like, well, I tried really hard. I spent all day looking for a job, right? I mean, they can't just go to the bar and just drink, cause, you know. I mean, they can. There's probably, the bars are probably packed. So, part, you know, that was some of it. Another part came from at the same time living in a cul-de-sac where there were a lot of foreclosures, and so you'd have like a perfect house and then like a foreclosed house with like a dirt lawn in front, and then you'd have like a vacant lot where they ran out of money to even build a house, and then the next house would again be like a perfect house and the guy would be like edging, you know, out there edging his square of lawn. And you know, that was a very, to me, a very interesting image that of sort of enclosure, you know, like my enclosure is going to be perfect even if the rest of the street just goes to shit. Like my little box, it, you know, and again, it was like, you know, there were five styles of homes that just replicated through the whole subdivision. But, you know, the idea that this guy would be, you know, mowing his lawn every 3 days, it was always the same length, you know, and out there edging and everything and power washing his walls and stuff, while the next house is literally, like, empty and dirty. And I just thought, like, wow, like, what are we that we do that? Mm. That we sort of, like, shut off the rest of the street somehow and just sort of protect our thing, you know. You know, those things in combination sort of filtered into me thinking like, well, I want to write about this. I knew I didn't want to make a record about it because I had just come off of a record and we had done a bunch of shows and I needed a little break. It took a bunch of notes and it started to sort of come together, the story of a man who was essentially unemployed, because Keith as an astronaut is essentially unemployed for the course of the book. But he's too dense to really understand, to have the empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, and the book is in some ways about him figuring out what empathy even is. Mm-hmm. And that's more or less where it came from. You know, if you read a collection of interviews with songwriters, they talk repeatedly about it coming from the sky. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, some say it comes from God, But they all, that's the metaphor that they use. Like, it comes down, into them from somewhere, you know. That's really interesting.
Do you know what I think it, the way I feel it? I feel it like there's a river.
Yeah.
And I feel like I jump in the river, or the river jumps in me, or something. Something happens with the river, but I feel it. I feel it up there. I feel this river.
I think Jim Harrison does, too.
Really?
Well, if you... I think in his poetry, that's the source, of the insanity.
Why don't you read us a little more?
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want space or do you want cul-de-sacs?
Cul-de-sacs.
You. Who let him in?
You already gave us space.
That's true. I'll give you the empty house. So, in the Odyssey, when Odysseus comes home, his kingdom is in chaos. But you know, his wife has essentially stayed true, and although the suitors are there, and his son is off doing something ridiculous, you know, the important components are still there to be put back into position. When Keith Corcoran comes home, this is what happens. Oh, so. Incidentally, International Space Station missions for astronauts are about 6 months long, so that's how long he's been gone. There was no sound at all, and what sense of movement he generated upon entering returned to him from every surface as if the house had become some kind of empty museum, his footfalls echoing off the tiles and the clunk of the closing door behind him so abrupt and alien that he actually shivered as he moved forward into the entryway, setting the two black suitcases by the door and flipping the light switch, the tiles in the carpeted room before him illuminating all at once, dull, white, empty. He stood there as if his delay might somehow undo what he had already seen, but his hesitation only confirmed the silence and vacancy. She had left the coat hooks hanging by the door, but the coats themselves were gone. Through the squared archway leading into the living room, he could see the enormous sofa, but there was no other furniture visible whatsoever. He had known this would be the case, that the house would be empty, and yet he had not expected the totality of it, the sofa's singular presence there, a grim and ironic goodbye in the guise of overstuffed gray leather. Empty. Absolutely empty. He moved through the downstairs with military precision, flicking on each light as he passed. The refrigerator continued to hum in the kitchen, but he did not open its door. Instead, he went to the cabinets and inventoried each one in turn. A few boxes of cereal, undoubtedly stale, and various cans of odds and ends. Peaches and fruit cocktail, string beans, canned yams. He did not even know who ate these things. Himself, his wife, his daughter. Items not worth moving, or at least not worth moving for her. An extra key to the house on the countertop and a smaller gold key, for what purpose he did not know. No note left behind. Instead, canned yams. So then I'll read you one little paragraph of cul-de-sacs just for you, after which you should leave. No. For the audience at home, we're all smiling. At last he returned to the car and pulled into the street and to the end of the court, and then turned onto the farther street beyond and turned again. Another court amidst more stunted trees and the occasional empty lot, and he followed the curve of that cul-de-sac and exited, only to find himself approaching the rounded sidewalk of yet another court. The lawn beyond the windshield, a yellow waste of dead grass. It is true that things turn out this way. One moment you are an astronaut floating high above a space station at the end of a robotic arm of your own design. The next you are driving through an endless suburb. He again swung the car around and cursed to himself. Grass-covered squares and rectangles, seemingly identical cul-de-sacs appearing and disappearing as he passed, different only in their state of completion. A perfect model home, then the skeletal structure of a wooden frame, then a patch of bare dirt holding an unfinished foundation. Between these states, a fractal landscape of courts and ways that turned inward upon themselves, thin and many-legged spiders that had, in death, curled into their own bulbous bodies, clutching the empty, still air between perfectly manicured lawns. That was the funny part.
Do you guys have any questions? Christian?
I've got a little
actually, I do actually. I have a question.
Yay!
So, Peter.
Peter.
The Ukrainian guy.
You've read?
I love him.
I do too.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Do you know someone that's Ukrainian? How did you know how to write?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, when you read him, his dialogue, I guess you can call it, it's like I had a friend that's Ukrainian, and you hit it spot on.
Cool.
I mean, the accent is just, I mean, I can hear it as I'm reading. It just cracks me up.
Yeah, good.
I mean, not to make fun of someone's.
Well, it's hard to write. It definitely is. I mean, it took many drafts to figure out what Peter would be able to say in English and what he wouldn't. His wife, Luda, has a little bit more vocabulary than he does, even though she protests that he's the better speaker, which struck me also as very Ukrainian. So I teach at American River College in Sacramento. And it's in many ways the most inner city community college that we have up there. My students are united in the fact that the majority of them are broke. And we have a lot of immigrants, especially from Ukraine and Russia and the stands, Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and some guy named Stan and some other Stans, Denver Stan. And when I decided it would be Ukraine, and part of that was I knew I wanted it to be Eastern Europe, and I didn't want it to be Russia, because that I think people have a thought about Russia. Or they think they know what Russia's about, and people sort of don't in America know what Ukraine's about. So when I decided that, I listened really hard to my students. I talked a lot to my English as second language instructors about Ukrainian students and what they need extra instruction on, which meant I could erase those things from Peter. And I also talked to a lot of my Ukrainian students about their parents, about how they got here and why they came here, to try to understand what is, I think, for most Americans, totally impossible to understand, which is taking your entire family and everything you have that you can pack into a couple of suitcases and moving to a country where you maybe don't speak the language at all. Which for Americans is, I mean, that, like, I would never do that. I don't care what kind of opportunity there is somewhere else, because we don't really think that way. But my, the Ukrainian parents of the students that I spoke to, for them it was just, there's more opportunity there, and we have a way to get there, and that's good enough, And that's true of Peter. You know, his wife decides there's more opportunity for the kids, so let's go there. But then what happens to these immigrant adults in particular is that they were dentists in Russia, and that credential's worth nothing here. So they end up working in some factory making folding chairs, and then coming to American River College to try to get their nursing degree so that they can get back in the medical field somehow. So, I mean, it's really heartbreaking, and it's just such a courageous gamble for these people. And not just Ukrainians, but, a lot of immigrant students that we have from all over, Mongolia even, and all over the place. Just, I mean, it's hard to fathom.
I have a belief, and this is just a moment in my book, that the Pakistani guy who owns the Dairy Queen in Davis was a neurosurgeon. I believe that I can tell by the way he holds the blizzard upside down right before he gives it to you. that very sentence is in my book.
Yeah.
Dance party.
I had the same thought before. My phone was on and it was in my pocket right here, and I thought, oh boy. Time to turn that off. That was an exciting musical moment. The audience at home missed it, but just so the people, the people listening at home, everybody leapt up and did a little thing. So Pam,
yes.
Before you read, I don't travel. I sort of understand abstractly why people would travel.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really understand the drive. You said something interesting last night about your friend, partner, about asking him to come to Istanbul,
mm-hmm.
as a part of a healing process.
Right.
Well, that would, you know, that I would, not only would I never say that, but it would never even occur to me that would be part of anybody's healing process.
What I actually said last night was that my partner was very sad for a long time when we met, and we were talking about Keith Corcoran's sadness, and what I said was, I just thought, well, get over it. Like, I thought I could take him to Istanbul and it would all get better. That's what Christian's referring to.
Yeah.
He liked Istanbul.
Oh,
but it took a little longer.
You guys actually
after that.
Went.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You bet. I thought Istanbul was gonna fix it.
Yeah.
And I was shocked when it didn't.
Why were you shocked when it didn't? Because that works so well for you.
For me.
For you.
Yes. Yes, I confused him with me, as sometimes we do in relationships.
We do.
So you're asking me why do I love to travel?
Well, the whole book is about being, you know, essentially not at home.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I avoid that like the play. I mean, this trip to Denver, like, I mean, I literally don't travel. So this is, you know, being out in this unfamiliar place is very not like me.
Mm-hmm.
So reading your book, even, it was very sort of disconcerting. Not only is the narrative fragmented, but, I mean, we are in airplanes and in towns and trying to buy food from people whose language we don't share, and then little snatches of friends having dinner together, and you'll get like a little piece of a conversation in some place that's not Nepal. And those sections, you know, I'm reading and I'm like, oh, thank God, okay. And then like, oh my God, we're on an airplane again, here we go, you know. And now we're in Nepal and Istanbul and Thailand and just everywhere. So the drive to travel for you is obviously very important, and you've written about it everywhere. Where to borrow the kind of phrases that we got last night, where does that come from? In your psyche.
In my psyche.
Your soul.
Well, that's, you know, very much what this book is about, is where it comes from. I love to travel. You know, I the way you feel about my traveling is a little bit the way I feel about six children. Like, it's not so much that I wouldn't want six children, though I wouldn't want six children. It's that I can't imagine anyone wanting six children.
I can't even imagine.
And and so, for me, you know, like, you probably can't imagine having wanted to go to 68 countries, which is my current tally. So for me, you know, it's about being more comfortable not at home. You know, home is a dangerous, difficult place. And that was certainly true for me growing up, which is how this all started, as they say. But it's even true now, even though my home is quite wonderful and I share it with a person I love very much and dogs that we're going to drive until 3 in the morning to get to tonight, you know. Yeah. It's the notion of home that's difficult and complicated. And I don't trust myself when I'm home. Whereas you put me in this section I'm about to read, I'm about to get arrested in China, you put me in that situation and I am on the mark. I am at my best when I'm about to get arrested in China. And you put me at my own kitchen table and things start to get a little weird. So for me, it's certainly about going. My writing is driven by new experiences. My writing is driven by place and the thrill I have constantly, endlessly, about seeing a new place and learning about a place. I went to North Dakota for the first time this year. I have flown 80,000 miles already since January, which is just absurd. I understand that. But that's what I've done. And I went to North Dakota. I just happened to go to North Dakota for the first time, and I was so excited. It was March, you know, which is not the right time to go to North Dakota. And I had a blast, and I took a million pictures. You know, it thrills me to be somewhere I haven't been. So that's the good news. And then the dark underside of that is my discomfort level with sitting still, which is not yet solved here at 50, but I'm working on it. That's kind of the best. I'm really eager to get to the ranch tonight, and we'll be there for about 48 hours, and which kind of represents stillness in my life.
That's the still place.
That's the still place, yeah.
Just took 80,000 miles to get back.
Yeah, that's right. It just took me 80. I was there 80,000 miles ago on United, not to mention the other airlines. So I'll just read a little. It occurs to me that, you know, these books have flight in common in a certain way. In several manifestations of that word. And this book does go from place to place, just flipping through Newport, Oregon, Limitor Beach, California, Jiangxi, Tibet, Mallorca, Spain. You know, that's how it, Denver, Colorado. That's how it rolls. But in after a section of 12 places, there's a story that takes place on an airplane. And I will read this one, because it's one I haven't been reading on my own tour, and it's kind of a little self-contained unit, and the airplane stories are named after the flight number of the airplane. So this is CA, or China Air 4604. The stern-faced Chinese guard has taken my backpack behind a partition, and suddenly there is a great deal of shouting. I run through its contents in my head. The two thangkas I bought at the School for the Preservation of Tibetan Culture, the brass soup pots from the market, the thick cords that resemble curtain poles that the nomads wrap around their heads to indicate regional loyalties, red for the east, black for the west, the hand-lettered gold-leaf prayer books I bought for pennies out of an old man's satchel, could they count as antiquities? The long string of jingle bells made for a yak. Now the shouting has moved itself back out from behind the partition and is directing itself at me. The guard wears a semi-automatic weapon and several clips of ammunition on his belt. The yelling stops, and it is my turn to speak. I don't understand you, I say. Another string of angry Chinese spews from the guard's mouth, which I interpret more or less correctly as idiot, tourist, woman. I glance at my watch. My plane is scheduled to leave in 35 minutes. My connection in Chengdu, tight. Breathtakingly toxic. Even the Tibetans get dysentery there. Chengdu reminds me of the Los Angeles of Blade Runner after the sun has stopped coming out forever. It is not a place I want to get stuck. Look, I say, whatever it is, if it's a problem, keep it. I'm guessing it is my attitude he objects to, since we cannot understand each other's words. The guard blows his whistle, three short tweets, and two more guards appear on either side of me, grab my arms firmly but not roughly, escort me to a room down the hall. They leave me sitting there a long time. Long enough for me to miss my plane to Chengdu, long enough for me to miss my plane from Chengdu to Hong Kong, long enough for me to remember every detail of the film Midnight Express, the film that kept an entire generation of travelers from carrying drugs across any border, including some of us between states. A new guard knocks sharply twice on the door and enters, already yelling. He yells for several minutes, getting so close to my face that I can feel his breath on my eyeballs, but something in me refuses to cry. "I don't understand you," I say, the next time he pauses, and the next time, and finally, right over top of his voice when it seems like he won't ever shut up. Startled, he raises his hand, I think maybe to hit me. And in that second, I remember the knife, a woman knife, the vendor at the market had called it, with its yak antler handle and its 4-inch blade. I had thought it would be a perfect gift for my ultra-butch house-sitter, Pat. "The knife," I say. "I'm sorry, I didn't think. To me, it was just a souvenir." But of course, the guard can't understand any of that either. They leave me sitting another long time. I hear planes come in. I hear planes take off. At one point, I realize the windows are made of one-way glass. Finally, a man wearing a suit comes in. He grunts at me to rise, to follow, so I do. Back in security, he thrusts my backpack at me and hands me a boarding pass. I go through security again without incident. My woman knife, of course, is gone. Everything is broken on China Air Flight 4402, and the toilet reeks, and the four Chinese I am slammed into the middle seats with will not stop spitting onto the carpet. But compared to 5 years of hard labor at a Tibetan prison, it pretty much rocks. As the plane bumps along the mountainous air currents, I think about my father. About the time I was 17 and my mother went away for a week and left me in charge of his meals. One day I was racing home from my friend's house on my bike, hoping to get there before he did, and he drove his Cadillac right up behind me on the sidewalk and laid on the horn. And even after that, it all might have been okay, because dinner was only supposed to be assembled cold cuts on rye bread and tomato salad. I dropped my bike on the lawn and ran into the kitchen before he could get out of the car, but he came in just as I was opening a new jar of mayo and grabbed my shirt in the front and pinned me up against the wall and raised his hand in the same exact way the Chinese guard had, and I said, for the first time ever, "If you do this, I'll tell everyone you know." And my father let go of the front of my shirt and went in and turned on the Phillies game. When we began to descend, the flight attendant comes over the ancient speaker in a demonic whisper, and the cabin gets so animated, I think we must be about to crash. But then I remember reading that the descent off the Tibetan plateau to Chengdu is the steepest of any commercial flight path, even Cochabamba, Bolivia, where you plummet right past the face of one of the 15 Christs in South America that claim to be the world's largest, and before I know it, we are on the ground. Miraculously, I have not missed the last flight of the day from Chengdu to Hong Kong, and when I go to the gate, a new boarding pass appears. Stepping onto the Air Hong Kong jet is stepping squarely back into the first world, and when the flight attendant in her stylish purple suit and jaunty tam asks me what I would like to drink, I look at her twice to make sure she isn't kidding. One country, two systems, the customs official said to me when I left Hong Kong 2 weeks ago, and he can say that again. Just after we land beside the carnival neon of the Hong Kong skyline, the co-pilot heads down the aisle toward me with a look that tells me he has me in his sights. I suck in my breath as he stops in front of me. "Your knife, madame," he says, bowing deeply. "Thank you very much," I say, as I lift it from his hands.
See, that doesn't seem very fun. It seems terrifying and awful, and I would, unlike you, shit my pants when I was done peeing them. But it's the adventure.
Yeah.
It's the adventure.
Yeah. I like a challenge.
Yeah. Questions?
So, when you were reading Chris's book, and you have these associations with the excitement of travel, and then certain amount of dread with a long stay at home, the mundane system of that. Did you have any associations with the protagonist in there?
Sure. You know, there was a woman at the reading last night who said, well, no matter what he did, it doesn't matter whether he's an astronaut or whatever he does, the more important thing would be having children, she said. You know, and that just that very sentence makes me sort of quiver. Yes, I mean, the writing, you know, when he's in space is so glorious, you know, and it's such a glorious moment for him. And you know, nothing frightens me more than a cul-de-sac, except maybe a minivan. You know, I'm really afraid of those things. I'm afraid, like, if Hertz tries to give me a minivan, I spend my life in rent-a-cars. If they try to give me a minivan, like, it doesn't matter how late I am. You know, they call it an upgrade. Mm-mm. You know, I don't do minivans. Like, I just won't drive one. So all the things he got stuck with, I fear. But I also, you know, I also would have feared it if his wife were still there and his daughter was still there and everything was all happy, you know. And I mean, I guess that's another reason why, you know, again, I was so impressed with the book, because it really does take place at a Starbucks and a cul-de-sac, you know, the vast majority of it. And, you know, obviously the writing's so beautiful. And if the writing is beautiful enough, I'm happy reading whatever I'm reading. But the truth is, he was so interesting to me, even in that setting, which is almost by definition uninteresting, but is particularly uninteresting to me. You know, I can read a bad book if it's set in Tibet. You know what I mean? So yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I was thinking about, just when I was choosing that to read, I was thinking about flight. I've written lots of essays about flight, about literal flight, and then about flight from domesticity and other things. And Keith's, I mean, in a sense, Keith protects himself from relationship and love and family with math, but, you know, also in the guise of this quest, or not the guise, additionally this quest for space, which no one would say, well, you should be at home being a good father when you're an astronaut. Like, it's such a sexy thing to be. So he got away with it, you know. I mean, I find Keith really interesting. I find him so interesting because it's not so simple that his child dies and, you know, and that's it. You know, it's not at all simple like that. He made lots of choices about his life, and he wants to keep making them even after the disaster, but NASA won't let him. You know, so so all of that is really complex and interesting to me. But I'm talking about your book.
That sounds a lot better when you talk about it than when I talk about it.
I have a question, kind of related. Like, to me, it seems, and I haven't read the book yet. I'm buying it tonight. The panel
good answer.
Talking about it, and it is on my list. So I'll be checking it off my list tonight as I carry it. But it seems important. I was earlier this year at Kennedy Space Center, and it's just a really interesting place to go now in the state of the space program. So to me, it feels like it would be really important in a symbolic way that he is an astronaut.
Yeah.
And what that loss to the imagination is, especially culturally in the U.S.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing, essentially what's happening with NASA is... that, you know, NASA's purpose is to sort of move forward and explore space. And what NASA has gotten itself into is taxi service, basically. So one of the things that's been happening with NASA is this kind of reorganization that's based on the notion of, we already know how to get people to the space station and back, so let's stop doing that. And let's have anyone else do that for us. So you know, Target or somebody is going to take over the essentially what used to be literally the shuttle service, right? So that NASA can ostensibly put all of its resources and brain power into things like yesterday's Mars landing, right? And hopefully we'll be seeing more of that and less. Space shuttle launches totally stopped being news. Right, which I found very interesting, because it used to, you know, I remember the all of the early ones, you know, like getting up super early to watch it on TV, you know, and just going like, yeah, a little kid going, yeah, it's awesome, And now, well, now we don't have them at all, but it ceased being newsworthy, which just tells you how ordinary it had become. And NASA should not be ordinary. They should be landing Curiosity rovers on Mars, you know. So part of it's that. You know, and I do think that the timing of the book, and I paid no attention whatsoever to the current state of NASA when I was working at it. The timing of it coming out with NASA being sort of reorganized and kind of pulled back and the space shuttle program stopping, that was just dumb luck on my part. That this book about this essentially unemployed astronaut came out right when a bunch of astronauts became unemployed. In fact, I've had interviewers ask me, like, if it was planned. Like, if the book is actually just a metaphor for the end of our space program. And I'm like, well, first of all, the space program hasn't ended. Mm-hmm. So let's not panic. But no, it was just unfortunate luck. You know, I'm very pro-space program, and my wife and I have these discussions all the time because she's very pragmatic. And for her, it's like, that's a lot of money that we could be spending on you know, feeding people or something that's very tangible. But, you know, you don't know what the benefits of space exploration are going to be. I mean, we got Tang out of space exploration. We got Velcro out of space exploration. And think of a world without Tang or Velcro. When I think of a world without Tang or Velcro, I think of a world that I don't want to be in. Essentially the world of your book, actually. No. So when you think about what space exploration is good for, think about those two things. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is there one more?
Charles?
I was just thinking of Tang at home.
Do you?
I do.
Really?
They served Tang at one of the readings that I did. And then somebody said, there's the Buzz Aldrin, which is Tang and beer, I think, mixed together.
Oh, that's awesome.
Tang and beer?
Out Eastern Plains of Colorado, and there it was at Edwards Market, the whole like end cap of Tang.
Tang.
Wow.
And you probably have beer at home. So when you go home today, have a Buzz Aldrin. Have a Buzz Aldrin on me.
Can I call you in the middle of the night?
Feel free. Whatever you need to do. Whatever you need to do to get through the night.
All right. Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks
everybody.
For listening.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.